9 years ago, according to Hezbollah's Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the resistance movement achieved a godly victory over Israel. Through the destruction of a once invincible Israeli army's tanks and its departure from the battlefield because of the steadfastness of the Lebanese people, the 33-day war has etched itself in the minds of Lebanese as a milestone. In this edition of the debate, we look at the implications of the 2006 war.
August 14 marks the end of a war that Israel waged on Lebanon in the summer of 2006. The 33-day war pitted Israeli forces against the fighters of Hezbollah resistance movement. Israel attacked both Hezbollah's positions and civilian infrastructure in Lebanon. Hezbollah was widely seen as the winner of the conflict because it led to the withdrawal of Israeli forces from southern Lebanon based on a UN resolution approved to cease hostilities. In one of the battles during the war, Israel lost a number of its main battle tanks, Merkava, in Lebanon's Wadi al-Hujair Valley. On Friday, the area hosted a ceremony to mark the 9th anniversary of Hezbollah's victory against Israel, with the movement's Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah addressing a huge crowd. Nasrallah hailed the steadfastness against Israel during the 2006 war, saying it brought an end to Israel's aggression against Lebanon. He noted that the resistance has also changed the regional power equation in the Middle East.
This resistance brought about victories. It also made achievements, and it changed the equations. And it also toppled the projects of occupation and hegemony in Lebanon and the region. And it imposed itself as standing way ahead in the developments in the region.
Nasrallah also touched on the ISIL terrorist group and the so-called U.S.-led war against it in Iraq and Syria. He said the U.S. is not serious in fighting the ISIL, but using the terrorist group to achieve its own goals.
Today, America is using ISIL for the sake of dividing the region. America is not serious in any way whatsoever in the war on terrorism and the war on ISIL. America wants to take advantage of ISIL in order to redraw the region once again, in order to topple governments, in order to topple regimes, and in order to bring about or draw new maps.
Hezbollah's fighters have been active in the fight against terrorism in Syria, assisting Syrian forces to retake key areas for militants and terror groups, including the ISIL. Hezbollah says it's determined to counter threats posed by Israel and terrorists, which many observers believe are now politically aligned.
Let's introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. We're joined by Mr. Sukant Chandon, who is a filmmaker and political commentator, and he's joining us live from London. And we're also joined by Mr. Richard Weitz, who is with Wikistrat's analytic community expert, and he's joining us live from Washington. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us for this edition of the debate. Mr. Weitz, I'd like to start with you. How do you reflect on this 9th anniversary of the 2006 war waged by Israel and Lebanon, as well as its outcome and consequences?
Well, it's interesting in that at the time we thought it'd have a major impact on regional dynamics. But I would argue now, because of the Arab Spring, the civil war in Syria, the renewed fighting in Iraq, the Iran nuclear deal, and so on, its impact has not been great in retrospect. I think these other developments have overshadowed it.
All right, Mr. Chandon, I imagine you disagree with that, but Mr. Weitz is saying not much of an impact. How do you feel about this?
Good evening, brother, and all to the listeners. And it's an honor to be on Press TV to commemorate the heroic resistance of Lebanese Hezbollah in defeating the white settler entity some 9 years ago now. Doesn't time fly? Actually, I don't necessarily disagree with what Mr. Weitz is saying, but Mr. Weitz is saying what he's saying in his own particular frame, political framing. But actually, Mr. Weitz preempted what some of the analysis I was going to make, because I too was going to say that the victory in 2006 was a historical moment which really developed the independence forces in the region. Prior to it, we had two important developments in the region, which were historic and strategic in the interest of the people of the region. Firstly, it was the outbreak of the second or Al-Aqsa Intifada in the fall or autumn of 2000, which raged until about 2003, 2004. And then in 2003, we had the British and US project of invasion and occupation of Iraq, which was met by a united Iraqi resistance. The resistance was sectarianized by the West and its regional forces, and also the Palestinian Intifada petered out. The Palestinian Intifada and the Iraqi resistance was then met strategically by the victory of Lebanese Hezbollah in 2006. But where Mr. White is correct in some senses, that trajectory of strategic victories from the Intifada to the Iraqi resistance to Lebanese Hezbollah in 2006, that momentum has been sabotaged directly by the Arab sting. And what the leading NATO powers and its regional allies have done to Libya, and particularly Syria, is nothing other than a strategic revenge operation for the victories of Lebanese Hezbollah back in 2006.
Mr. White, you know, speaking about Hezbollah's victory in 2006, you know, Israel has always been the American obsession with Israel is that it should remain stronger militarily in the region. Now, we know that in 2006, during that war, the Hezbollah fighters, resistance fighters, were able to target Merkava tanks, which were before that seen as legendary tanks, you know, the best of Israeli ammunition out there. Wasn't that a pivotal moment in many ways, which proved that Israel was not invincible? And even however much America did to protect it and give it arms and ammunition, it could not be protected against, as Mr. Nasrallah today said, the steadfastness of the people.
This has happened before. As you recall, the 1973 war went far to show that there were vulnerabilities in any military. In that case, the Israelis were caught off guard by strategic surprise and then by the effectiveness of the Egyptian surface-to-air missile network. They eventually overcame it. I think that they identified the flaws in the vulnerability of their armor forces in Lebanon, but we don't know since there hasn't been a tank battle since then. But I think that it also highlighted, just as before, the surface air systems highlighted the vulnerability of modern aircraft to ground-based missiles. So this highlighted the vulnerability of tanks, particularly when not accompanied by suitable infantry support to anti-tank missiles.
But then, Mr. Weitz, isn't that an important, at least psychologically, to get over that obstacle of seeing Israel as invincible? You know, it's not just about the tanks, as you said, that was something that I imagine has been fixed by the Israelis. But when we talk about the psychological impact here, that Israel is not invincible, it can be defeated by standing strong.
The impact, you know, the impact's been mixed. It's had a negative effect on the Israeli approach to the peace process. They're much more reluctant now to make concessions. But that was more what happened in the Gaza situation, where they gave up the territory they saw in Gaza only to see it come under the control of a group that they feel uncomfortable working with. And I think that's made them more reluctant to make the concessions. As opposed to going to war with another country, the Israelis have not done so. I'm not sure if it's due to reluctance, it's just they haven't seen necessity. They have okay relations with Egypt. Syria is basically engulfed in its own civil war. And there hasn't been any confrontation on the northern front in Lebanon. So basically, they've been focused on Iran, and that so far is still in play.
Mr. Chandan, I'm wondering, what do you feel about this shattering of this facade of Israel's invincibility?
Well, of course, it's important for the victims of the white colonial settler state and its senior allies in Western capitals and its allies in the region, particularly the Persian Gulf monarchies and the Turkish state, or the Turkish government, at least at the moment. But, you know, the Merkava tank was blown up as well by the Palestinian resistance in the Second Intifada and in the Gaza resistance as well. And the Chinese government actually cancelled a deal with the Merkava tanks after the Palestinian resistance had obliterated them in the resistance, because what does China want with a tank that can be blown up by a popular guerrilla movement? Also, Mr. White, I'm befuddled by what Mr. White has just said as well, because I think perhaps Mr. White has either forgotten or may not be aware that the Zionist entity has bombed Syria some 4, 5, 6 times in the last 3 years. And they haven't bombed Daesh or Jabhat Nusra or al-Sham, one of these other crazy death squads. They've bombed either the Syrian government or its allied forces in Lebanese Hezbollah, etc. So I think it's very clear that so-called Israel is still a very provocative, aggressive entity in the region, and it still remains an imperialist dagger pointed at the heart of the Arab nation and the people of the Middle East.
I wanted to pick up on that point that Mr. Chandan there mentioned, Mr. White's, and put that to you. When we talk about Israel and this fight against Daesh or ISIS or ISIL, however you put that, it's interesting, is it not, that Israel seemingly stands on one side of that and Hezbollah is the one fighting against it. As much as the world may title Hezbollah a quote-unquote terrorist organization, it's actually it which is fighting against the major terrorist organization of the region. And Israel is on video proving, you know, that it's supporting or at least giving medical attention to many of these ISIL fighters. Why is that, do you think?
I think that Israel, like the United States and other countries, find the Syrian situation difficult to deal with because there's not much enthusiasm for the Assad government, but there's concern about what might replace it, be it the ISIL-Daesh forces, be it al-Nusra and al-Qaeda. And this has made it difficult for Israel, US, and other countries to make a clear policy towards Syria. And it's seen even now in the relationship with Turkey and so on. So I do recall, yes, that the Israelis used some force in Syria. As far as I can understand it, these were attempts to destroy missiles and other weapons that they thought were going to be provided to Hezbollah. But that's been the extent of their intervention so far.
But that's interesting, is it not, Mr. Weiss? And I want to push you on this point, that if it was, in fact, Israel attacking Hezbollah in Syria, which was what the claim was, isn't that interesting, because Hezbollah is the one fighting the terrorists?
Exactly.
Yes, but it's not the only contradiction we've got, because we've got the same thing with the Kurds. The Kurds are the leading opponents and most effective fighters often against the extremist groups. But the...
Okay, we seem to have some trouble with the audio there. Mr. Chandan, I wanted to get your opinion on that then. How do you feel about what's just been said with Mr. White's?
Yeah, sorry, I've lost all audio in my earpiece. But just to take up on that point, you know, there's parallels with the PKK, and I'm not talking about the Northern Iraq Kurdish organizations, who are much more collaborative and problematic, but the PKK and their allied forces in northern Syria or South Kurdistan are the most effective force against Daesh there. But again, with Turkey and its Western allies in the leading countries of NATO, it's very clear who they're targeting strategically. They're not targeting Daesh and the death squads. They've always been targeting for 3-4 years the pro-PKK forces, YPJ and YPG in northern Syria around Rojava, Kobani, etc. And now you can see the Turkish military are bombing PKK in northern Iraq with not a peep of criticism or concern from its senior West allies. And exactly the point of the Zionist entity attacking Hezbollah and other and the Syrian government and other allies in Syria is to weaken Syria as a resistance pro-independence base, an anti-Zionist, anti-imperialist base, which the Syrian government has always been, and it continues to be. The point of the Arab Sting is to destabilize, to knock out any strategic or any potential opposition to Western imperialism and its regional allies, but also to strike at Syria. To the attempt, at least, is to remove Syria from the resistance axis, so then the so-called Israel and its Western senior colleagues can then, they think, deal with Hezbollah without that Syrian and also Iranian Islamic Republic support. But 2006 shows that not only Merkava tanks can be hit, we remember this farcical drop of Israeli soldiers in the Bekaa Valley who had to just run up into their helicopters and run away as well. Also, we saw the targeting of the Israeli warship in the Mediterranean when Nasrallah made one of his brilliant speeches. And also, Nasrallah summed up the strategic efficacy of Lebanese Hezbollah when he said those beautiful words that we can reach beyond Tel Aviv and beyond Tel Aviv. And this is the strategic notion which is haunting the corridors of power in Tel Aviv and its allies in Paris, Washington, and London, that if they dare try another provocation against the Lebanese people, Hezbollah will not only match the ferocity of popular resistance that they meted out in 2006, but they have more prizes up their sleeves. So if you want a go, give it a go and you will see. But this is what haunting imperialism and the Zionist state.
Speaking of Sayyid Nasrallah's words, Mr. Chandan, I'm wondering, you know, he also today spoke about who benefits from talk of division and destruction and bloodshed within the countries of this region, saying specifically, of course, that America and Israel benefit from that, saying that that was, in fact, their strategy in the region at this point. Why do you think that we are seeing this strategy playing out?
Well, it's the comment I made before that, you know, strategically imperialism and the Zionist entity were absolutely alarmed that not only were they facing a Palestinian intifada, not only a relatively and much more relatively than today, a united Iraqi resistance against, across all confessions, united against the occupation of the British and the United States. And on top of that, you saw the victory of Lebanese Hezbollah. So it was just obvious that they needed to divide the Iraqi resistance. And the central tool for that was sectarianism, and the central people to facilitate that were these Takfiri supremacist death squads who are nothing but an asymmetric mirror opposite, a mirror example of Western white supremacy, i.e., just like the Zionist state, they consider themselves God's given people, and everyone outside off that level of humanity are dehumanized and can be wiped out, whether you're Shia, Sufi, Christian, Orthodox, Assyrian, Kurdish, etc.
Okay, Mr. Weitz, I believe Mr. Weitz is back with us. If you can hear me, Mr. Weitz, I wanted to get your opinion on this then. Sayyid Nasrallah speaking about how division in the region of different countries benefits America and Israel. How do you feel about that statement?
Well, it's a mixed picture. I mean, certainly the divisions make it harder for the U.S. to rally support behind some of its objectives, be that, for example, at the moment, solidifying a support behind the Iraqi government or holding a line on Iran sanctions and so on. On the other hand, it also means that the U.S. Is forced to engage in differential diplomacy. It's got to balance relations with Turkey and Israel and the Saudis and so on. And it makes it complicated, but that's not unusual. I mean, these divisions are common in most regions of the world, and so it's something that the U.S. has basically to manage everywhere.
Mr. Weitz, isn't it interesting because, you know, when I originally asked you, Mr. Weitz, at the beginning of this show, what kind of an impact the 2006 war had on the strength of the resistance, you said not much. But then isn't it this strategy of division, didn't this come into play after that 2006 war with a lot more enthusiasm, if I may use that word, ever since that 2006 war because of the strength of the resistance?
Sorry, sorry, there's some kind of echo effects. I didn't get the first part of the question. Something, there's an impact of 2006, and I didn't hear the dimension.
Right, let me just repeat myself. You earlier said that there was very little impact after the 2006 war and what Hezbollah sees as its victory. But then at the same time, we're seeing this new strategy, as you yourself spoken about right now, about division in the region. Didn't that all happen a lot quicker after 2006?
I don't know. I recall the region being divided through most of the post-Cold War period. I mean, there was during the Cold War, the Soviets and the Americans would line up their allies, and then you had the allies switch. You know, there'd be a revolution in Iraq or a change in government in Egypt, and they'd switch back and forth. So this has often occurred. Even on the question of Israel, the Arab governments have been divided, I think that this is something that it's fairly common that you're going to get these kind of divisions as the local governments try and search for external partners to support their policies. I don't think the 2006 war had any major impact in that direction, one way or another.
Okay, Mr. Chandan, I wanted to get your opinion on that then. Was division always here, and are things just going along naturally, basically?
Well, there's a number of mainstream commentators, well-respected commentators, including Seymour Hersh, who has argued in his article entitled The Redirection, that exactly after 2006, of the victory of Lebanese Hezbollah, that there was a turn against the resistance axis, a strategic turn against, in that the unity between London and Washington, especially with Riyadh and Ankara, in sectarianizing the region was a very deliberate and conscious policy and strategy. And of course, it's covert, not overt, because you know you can't team up with the most depraved death squads on the planet and say, we've just teamed up with the most bloody, depraved, lynching, sexually enslaving people that you can find anywhere in the Middle East. No, you have to spin them as rebels and revolutionaries, as they have through the Arab Sting, teaming up with the most sordid forces in Libya, and then the most sordid, depraved forces in Syria. But perhaps Mr. White will call them freedom fighters and revolutionaries, and you know, the kind of the nice purged rebels that Obama and the US administration has been developing, who turn out to be nothing else but similarly sectarian and depraved death squad forces, who sometimes fight Jabhat Nusra and Daesh and sometimes team up with them and ally with them in Syria as well. So no, definitely the sectarian strategy is a central tool, part of the toolkit of Western interests in the region. And no, it's not common, and no, it hasn't always been there. Actually, the region has seen a lot more unity and a lot more stability within the given countries and between the countries itself. This sectarianization is primarily emanating from London and Washington.
Okay, on that point, we'll have to end it. But of course, gentlemen, we do appreciate both of your contributions to this show. That was Mr. Sukant Chandan, filmmaker and political commentator, who had been speaking to us live from London. And we were also joined by Mr. Richard Weitz, Wikistrat's analytic community expert, who had been speaking to us live from Washington. And of course, viewers, we do appreciate you joining us as well for this edition of The Debate. Until next time, good night.